Session number 8255.
Mr. Broom, Reel 3. How
Reel.
did the Kuomintang Chinese compare with the Communist Chinese?
They were socially higher in a higher echelon, and most of them pretty well educated in Chinese. They were actually people of initiative and character, or they wouldn't have been in Chongqing in the first place, because they went up there to do something against the Japanese. They were somewhat similar to the Chinese communists in that they would very easily interpret something you said as an insult to the Chinese or something like that. But we learned to avoid any trouble of that kind. They're very sensitive in that way, the Chinese. And, well, we've got on with them splendidly with these people.
What type of things would they both take up exception to?
Well, it's difficult to think of an instance straight away. But I can tell you something which would illustrate the point. From what happened, an incident that took place later on when we were installed in the Malayan jungle, it was a question of charging the battery for the wireless sets. Now, we had manufactured, more or less, a bicycle charger, and it was very hard work charging this thing. It was rather like riding a bicycle up a steep hill in top gear. And our Kuomintang Chinese, who are with us, told us that they would not do that work, leaving it to be done by the four Europeans we had then, because we weren't going to ask the communist people to do it anyway. It wasn't part of their agreement with us. And they went on strike for about a fortnight. It was all boiled over in the end, but they thought that we were regarding them as cheap labor or something of that kind, I think it was. But that was the sort of touchiness you had to guard against, you see.
Was there any sign of what's sometimes alleged to be Chinese xenophobia?
No, not really. No, I don't think so. All Chinese think the white people are inferior and rather mad, but it didn't show that in that case, no.
So, to pick up the narrative again, you'd recruited the Kuomintang Chinese. Can we go on to what you did?
Yes. We had the first batch of Chinese came. I think there were about 10 or 12 of them. And what was to be done? Well, they had to be trained in sabotage work and all the sort of underground warfare work. Now, we already had, by that time, a training school set up by the India main office near Pune at a place called Kadak Vasla. Now, this was a place on the top of a mountain which had been a Mughal fort, and it was the most marvelous place for a training ground. They not only had land on the top of the hill, but they'd had another camp at the bottom, and it had a lake on which you could be trained in nautical stuff at the same time. And they trained a number of different parties there. Well, we were allotted to go on to the top of this mountain, and we joined them in this training, of course, and we had a splendid time. Because although we were in a hurry to get away, in fact, you couldn't hurry it up beyond a certain tempo, because all throughout all this training and stuff, planning had to go on about how the deuce we were going to get into Malaya. And this meant a very lot of delicate negotiations with the Navy in particular. There were at that time only two submarines operating in those waters on our side, and they were both Dutch. They were submarines which had escaped from Holland just before it fell, and had been attached to the British Navy, and they were operating in these waters. There were no British submarines out there at all. But, of course, for operational purposes, they were part of the British Navy, and our negotiations had to be done with the Navy, which, quite rightly, in my opinion, is extremely chary about unusual operations, clandestine operations. They reckon it keeps them away from their real job. So these negotiations took a long time. So we had plenty of time to fill in with all this training and so on in Pune. And it really was a really rather pleasant part of the war, because the place we were in was, in peacetime, a holiday hotel place. Also training with those Chinese was my boy Chun. Jamal had been attached to the Berkshire Regiment or something in India and just settled down immediately to be a British soldier. He's perfectly happy. But our Chun was a different matter, and he was determined to get trained as a guerrilla and follow me even further. So that was arranged, and he joined with the others in the training. But again, he was both educationally and socially in a slightly inferior class. But fortunately, with the Chinese, class doesn't sort of matter all that much. They get on pretty well together. Anyway, he joined them. And so we had this curious period where Davis and I spent our time partly at the training camp and partly wandering about all over India, meeting various offices of the Force 136 organization and arranging things here, there and everywhere. It took us between Calcutta, Delhi, Bombay, Madras and Ceylon. So we had quite a busy time travelling and so on. Can you stop it a minute? It takes the sort of operational headquarters of our little organisation consisted then of Davis and me. We considered it our operation, but also of Goodfellow, who was our commanding officer and did all the negotiation with the High Command. And Limbo Singh, who became almost the third man of a triumvirate with Davis and me, and was fully in with all the plans, and was an extremely helpful man because of his internal knowledge. Well, eventually it came to the point where something could be organized, and a Dutch submarine was allotted the task of the first operation. Now, we were totally out of touch with Malaya. No intelligence of any really useful kind was coming out of Malaya whatsoever. So somebody had to go in first and do a blind landing somewhere in Malaya. And that was arranged, and John Davis was the man chosen to do it. He chose himself, more or less. And he was to go with a screen of these Kuomintang Chinese. So he took five of them, because the landing was done in foil boats, collapsible canoes, which take two people each. So with five Chinese, he made a party of six, with three canoes full. Foil boats. German for folding boats, it was. Foil boats. And they were totally collapsible, so they could be stowed away in the submarine in bags and then put together when required. Well, Davis went out in this submarine, and the object of his operation was to land in Malaya, get in touch as quickly as he could with the communist guerrillas, any communist guerrilla organization which was operating, and arrange a liaison between them and our forces, and generally promote the guerrilla warfare effort in Malaya. Now, it was arranged that I was to follow at a suitable interval thereafter. and Davis was to arrange for rendezvous so that I could follow. Well, he went in and he made his landing at a place called Sigari, opposite, just north of Pankow on the Perak coast. That is a place where the jungle comes down, fortunately, almost to the sea's edge, so they could get into concealment pretty quickly on arrival. Well, the submarine duly made the place, and they set up their foil boats and got into them and paddled away and landed on this particular shore where they concealed their foil boats and marched inland. And almost at once, Davis sent two of the Chinese out of the jungle to make contact with the nearest civilization and start the business of starting an organization in the towns and villages, you see. That was their raison d'etre, really, was to make the thing viable so that they could have contacts with outside, as we've always called it.
Contacts without?
With outside. I mean, with the outside. We always talk about the outside once we were in the jungle. Now, this was in about May or June 1943. And I followed on the next submarine. It was 1 month, you see. And I followed on the next one to join Davis. I had one Chinese with me. I think it was only one. There was a rendezvous arranged south of Pankow. Davis was to come out in a fishing boat from Pankow, flying a red scarf over the gunwale, and we were to see him in daylight and then surface at night and pick him up. Well, it worked. We saw him all right, and surfaced at dusk, fixed up the foul boat, and paddled away. Sorry, may I go back? Will you stop it a moment? A correction to a previous statement. I did not have a Chinese with me on this occasion. It was a fellow policeman of Davis's, Claude Fenner, who was subsequently connected with all these operations, who came with me as conducting officer and to take back any report that we had to give. Well, I got into this foil boat with Fenner, and we paddled over to John Davis. We made the recognition signal, which was totally unnecessary because we had him in full view of our sights. And in any case, Davis had forgotten about the recognition signal and never gave us a reply, so we should have been more suspicious, but it was so obvious that all was well, that we went up to this fishing boat and spoke. And Davis immediately said, you're not coming in to join me. I'm coming out to report and make arrangements. Because he had found that he was an awful nuisance to his Chinese, because there he was sitting in the jungle, having to be concealed and unable to do very much at that stage. And they were burdened with feeding him and taking food in and out of the jungle and so on, and being a terrible nuisance. He said he wanted to give them a month to settle down before he came out again. So that was arranged. And so we paddled back to the Dutch submarine and said, sorry, you're going to have three people now instead of two, because none of us are landing. And so I had a return trip in this Dutch submarine.
Was it merely because he was a European that he was a nuisance?
That's right, yes. He couldn't be seen by anybody, you see. Well, so we got back to Sumatra. My morale was not very high then, because to have a totally abortive trip of 3 weeks and submarining in tropical waters is not a health trip at best. But anyway, we got back to Ceylon, and went on with more planning and more waiting. And a month later, at very short notice, Davis left again. Again on a Dutch submarine. He must have had a Chinese with him, and I can't remember that very well, because he went in and made a rendezvous similar to the one that I had made with him, and met up with his Chinese, and found things had advanced and he was all right. And the next month, I repeated the same operation and joined him in Sigari. But we hadn't been there for more than 2 or 3 days when it was, we were more or less told by the communists with whom we were then in touch that we must move. We must move to the center of the country, where we were much nearer the scene of events. And in any case, that had been the intention all along, to get into the middle. So we were by now in touch with Chin Peng, and he organized the our march to the interior. And it was done by, first of all, going down to the shore again, more or less where Davis originally landed, and being picked up by a Chinese sampan from there, and taken down to the mouth of the Pera River. And to get there, you have to pass the very populated port of Pankow, which is a great fishing port. And we were somewhat surprised to find that instead of going round the port and out at sea and taking us to the Pera River, they went straight through it. Of course, they were quite right. They said if we'd gone out, it would have looked odd. But there's nothing odd about a sampan driving straight through the port of Pankow. And we were safely ensconced down below, so that was all right. They took us down through Pankow and to the mouth of the Pera River, and where we were landed and taken to a hut where we lay up for a night. Well, from there on, we had 5 days of night marching with Chinese guides, and lying up through the day in various sort of hiding places in rubber estates or jungle. It was really well organized, this march. And finally, we ended up near the town of Bidor, where we were taken into a coffee shop which was swarming with Chinese, and we thought that was a bit odd that we should be so much exposed, but we were told, oh, not to worry, this is our territory, the Japs don't come here, you're quite safe. And then from there we were taken up into the jungle to a little ridge on which there was a camp of bamboo huts already set up for our reception, with a number of Chinese who were our bodyguards to look after us. I think there were about a dozen or more of them. So we stayed in this particular camp for quite a long time. We were tolerably comfortable in that camp, but it was only really supposed to be temporary. Now, meanwhile, we were told that Spencer Chapman was still alive and was in the jungle and in touch with the communists. He was the one man we had expected to be still alive, because he was that sort of chap. He was marvelous constitution and so on, a real survivor. So we said, well, if you can, we'd like to have him. And they said, all right, we'll bring him along. He'd been in Pahang somewhere. And sure enough, on Christmas Day, 1943, he walked into the camp. And that was the first sort of acquisition we had. It was a wonderful Christmas present indeed. And so he joined up. Now, the immediate thing was a question of ranks came up, because Chapman was officially senior to Davis army-wise. And so he, I suppose, officially should have taken command of this thing. But that was obviously totally out of the question. He hadn't been in on any of the planning. He didn't even know what we were there for. He didn't speak the local languages. He had no knowledge of the local customs and everything like that. And it was, we had to make it clear to him that he wasn't going to be in command, because it just couldn't be done. And he took that really well. He must have seen the whole sense of it. We were, of course, out of touch with headquarters. I ought to have explained that before. We took with us one of these very excellent radio sets that the SOE had invented and built for themselves, and the necessary generating equipment and so on. But when the Chinese took us on this night march, they said, rightly or wrongly, that they couldn't carry the equipment that time and that it would have to be left on the shore. Now, thinking of this subsequently, I'm fairly sure that they could have got this equipment up much quicker than they did, because we didn't see it again for a year, actually. But I think they were making their minds up about us, whether they were going to cooperate and all that sort of thing. And while they were making up their minds, it was much more convenient that we should be out of touch with our headquarters. I think that is probably the correct interpretation of it. Anyway, so you see, we had to make up our own minds about the seniority of Chapman and all that sort of thing. Chapman stayed with us, joined in with us as a part of the part of the headquarters staff, as it were, and it was a question of how we were to occupy ourselves. The only thing we could do from the point of view of the Chinese communists was to offer them a bit of training, and that couldn't be very, very much, because we hadn't ammunition for them to do any rifle practice or anything like that, and really there was very little we could teach them. But the main object was, of course, to plan to carry out the instructions we had, further the war effort in the jungle. We were lucky to have Chin Peng calling in on us very regularly, with whom we got on for these plannings, and eventually we had quite a conference with the top brass of the Communist Party. This was the first time that Lai Tak came into the picture, and one or two others. And over a couple of days, we hammered out a sort of agreement, which was to the effect that the Chinese would cooperate with CETO, which is the Southeast Asia, not, I beg your pardon, not CETO, SEAC, the Southeast Asia Command, during the re-invasion, during our reoccupation of Malaya, and would take orders from SEAC so far as necessary operationally. In reply, we would supply them with arms and supplies and training so far as we could. And this was the first agreement we made. Now, we were not totally out of touch with Colombo, as we called our head office. We were not totally out of touch because a series of rendezvous had been laid on with the submarine. Naturally, we didn't end up with my getting in there. There was going to be a submarine rendezvous at about once a month for at least three or four months. And these, of course, were very carefully staggered in place and time and that sort of thing, and were kept to start with. But whenever either Davis or I set out to try to keep a rendezvous with the submarine, it always transpired, from the communist point of view, that things were extremely dangerous outside of the jungle, and the Japs were patrolling everywhere, and that they couldn't, that no, they was, they couldn't get a European through. It may very well have been true at that time. So the only things we could do was to send out messages and send one of our Chinese to keep the rendezvous, you see. By this time, we had a we had a Chinese boat owner in Pankow, Rich Tauke, as they're called, rich businessman. He owned the fishing boats in Pankow, and he was cooperating beautifully. So whenever we wanted a boat for a rendezvous, we could have one, and send our chap out with messages to the submarine to keep them informed as well as we could. And it was quite interesting how to get these messages out. We used to write them on the very smallest bits of paper we could come across in absolutely minuscule writing and roll them up and conceal them in various ways. We concealed them in a tube of toothpaste and in a tin of Andrew's liver salts. And the final best one was in the brain pan of a huge fried fish, because the Japanese were constantly putting up roadblocks and searching people left, right and centre. But we got these messages away, and they did get through this way.
Could I at this stage ask you about how the Chinese communists coped in the jungle? Because from what you've said about their background, it sounds as though many of them came from urban backgrounds.
Not really. Mostly mining coolies lived really a more or less country existence. They used to live in large dormitories on the mines, and they'd go out and get firewood and all that sort of thing. It wasn't really urban in the way that you just went around to a shop and bought supplies and that sort of thing. They were perfectly capable of coping with jungle conditions, much better than Europeans were, because they were more used to the kind of diet you had to live on. And they were pretty good on that point.
Did they grow their own food or not?
We grew a little bit, but not very much, because when the worst came to the worst, and if we couldn't get food in from outside, we could always rely on the Aborigines. We were in among Aborigines sitting in the jungle, and the Chinese had been very clever with them and got them mostly on our side. And they would supply us with food if we were desperate, which was very rarely so, but it could be so. And when we asked them how we could recompense about it, and say, wasn't it taking their food from their mouths? And they said, oh, no, we shall never starve. And that's very true, because they, being born and bred in the jungle, knew how to live off it. They would never starve. They'd always have food, even if it was rather primitive kind. But we were all right